to Danny. Danny's a very unusual figure. I do recommend that any of you want to know more about Danny, you presumably all know quite a lot about him because you're here, but go on his website. Your website is fantastic. It's fantastic because one thing it doesn't mention is the kind of thing that everybody normally does, which is that you're the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at Oxford University. But you put in all sorts of interesting things about yourself. I won't sort of go over your whole history, but you mentioned, for instance, that you liked building sandcastles when you were young. You do talk about that in an incredibly engaging way. It made me see the educational potential of that. You talked about your own education and how you took time to develop, and therefore any system which we're under threat now, the thought of a system that would divide again at 10 or 11 would have left you behind. And you said you really started doing well at the age of 16. But the quote that I particularly want to pick from your website, which I just think is, it just really resonated with me, which is, I, Danny Dorling, am unlikely ever to be impressed by an A-level grade on its own, or even a string of A's. This is very revolutionary in the current climate. Or to believe it is much more than a signpost to your street, school and socialisation. I am unlikely to think that if you do not have a job, it is because of your personal failing, rather than the choices of the employer in your area, and what in turn affects them, and your luck and status when you enter the market. I am likely to be convinced that people in Britain do not know these things themselves. I just think that's a very thoughtful way of looking at something and kind of going against the convention, which I'm hoping you're going to do in your lecture. I must say one other thing, though, that Danny has written 12 books, at least, and hundreds of journal articles about all aspects of inequality. So we're really looking forward to hearing you give the Caroline Benn Memorial Lecture, and over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Melissa. Can you hear me at the back okay?
Yeah.
Great. I couldn't actually read a word until I was 8 years old, and which is why I'm very glad that grammar schools have been abolished in my area, because there's no way I would have passed the 11 plus. I'm stupidly going to try and read quite a lot of this, so I hope you're going to bear with me. I have to read some of it out because it appeared in The Guardian and they said I was going to say these things, so if I don't, they will appear to be lying. People sometimes say, why do you write in The Guardian when it's just preaching to the converted? And in a way, what am I doing standing here? Because I suspect many of you are the converted. The reason for doing this and for writing in The Guardian is I do not think the converted have yet got it right. I don't think we collectively have good enough solutions and suggestions to put forward to people, and that is why it is worth doing these kind of things. It's not just about saying how great we are and what brilliant ideas we've got. We've actually got to come up with better ideas than the ones that we have been coming up with recently. The other reason for reading this out is I've got a few quotes. Tawny, Michael Young and Caroline Benn herself. Somebody asked me if I could say something about Trump as well, which is uplifting, instead of education. And I'm a glass half full person, and my instant reaction was, Trump's very good news for education, because Trump demonstrates that no matter how unskilled you are, how much little knowledge you have, anybody really can get anywhere. Now, Barack Obama, that didn't work for. Barack clearly was a very gifted individual. You can't aim to be like him. But the fact that Trump has become president of the USA shows that we are not a world in which only a few superhuman people can get to the top. Okay, he has money. I haven't cheered you up, have I? Let's try it later. Okay. I'm going to start with my first quote. And my first quote comes from the Compass Inquiry into the New System of Education that we need. This was published in March 2016, and I agree with it. And they say, the big problem is this, how small our education system has become. By small, we mean narrow, restrictive, and lacking in ambition and imagination. For both learners and teachers, the space in the system is claustrophobic and does not allow people to stretch and expand. to push and be pulled, and to know a life without limits. Schools have become factories of limited learning to fit one dominant view of what it means to be human, the worker consumer in a competitive global economic race, at a time when for so many work no longer pays enough to live by, let alone provide work that allows us to flourish. It is small in the sense that too much of it is selfish and self-serving at a time when success increasingly comes from collaboration and cooperation. It forces us to look down at short horizons, not up at fast landscapes of what a good society could look like. I think our education system in the UK, in the four countries of the UK, is very bad at the moment. And it's very bad compared with what is normal on the European mainland, which is to have far less segregation in general. Private schools are almost non-existent on the mainland. We spend up to 30% of our secondary education budget privately. Only Chile spends more. This is one of the strangest things to do. We know, as I come on later, that the outcomes are not particularly good for our children, especially when we measure the outcomes around about age 24. And that matters because what we have is a system of education which teaches very narrowly to a national curriculum. I've talked to a lot of teachers recently who have told me that they have not been able to devise one lesson on their own that didn't fit that curriculum because of what the schools needed. That's quite incredible. So we're teaching to a very restrictive curriculum to get children to get the highest grade they can get in an exam on a day. And the way we know that this is bad is that when the international authorities test young adults across all of Europe at age 24, our young adults are the ones who are least able at literacy in English, are least able to solve problems, and have the worst numeracy of any country in Europe by age 24, because they've just been taught to get a grade at age 16 or age 18. Anecdotally, I'll go back to my script in a minute, but anecdotally, one of the saddest things of turning up at Oxford University 3 years ago was I thought that I would be able to say to undergraduates at Oxford, OK, here are some things to read. I'm not going to give you too much because I don't want you to get exhausted. That tends to happen at Oxford. I'm going to tell you some things which are interesting to read. And I won't give you a clue as to what will be in the exam, so you can relax and just read them and enjoy yourselves and then take the exam. Naively, I thought, you know, I can do this here. That's what reading for a degree is. The look of horror on the faces of my 18-year-old undergraduates at the idea that I wasn't going to steer them towards a particular set of exam questions that they could learn and then regurgitate after a year was striking. They were absolutely terrified of the idea of being told, go away and read some things, I'll give you some lectures, it'll be interesting, and we'll have a fairly random exam. Because, and I should have realised this, at Oxford, more than any other university, they are exam conditioned guinea pigs. They are the children who have got the A stars at GCSEs in 6, 7 or 8 subjects, A star, A star, A at A level. What they are good at is exams. And the idea of not having to work for an exam, of course, is terrifying if that is what you've done from the age of 5 to 18. Occasionally there might be the odd 19-year-old there. It's not very diverse. And if this is the top of our education system, if that's what it's supposed to be producing at its very best, is a set of petrified 18-year-olds, it is tragic. It's absolutely tragic. Let me get back to this. Stuart Hall, in 2005, wrote about Labour's double shuffle. And this was criticism of Tony Blair, the disingenuous way that the Blair government managed to take us backwards while claiming to make progress. The double shuffle, he said, occurred partly out of a lack of both bold proposals to take two steps forward again. And to quote Hall exactly, he bemoaned that there had been no reinvention of the state education system under the Blair government. First we got academy schools, and that led to what we currently have in the fractured system. Then we got university fees, at first only 1,000, then only 3,000, don't worry, they won't raise again. But it was the Blair government that set these things in place. It might have been well-meaning, the academies might have been the school that most needed to be revamped, but whoever did it didn't think forward enough as to what could then happen. Exactly the same with the fees. So we now have the most expensive university fees in the world. Hall was trying to explain that often we get a step backwards, then we get two steps forward. Unfortunately, in 2010 with the coalition, we got a further step backwards, and in 2015 with the Conservative majority, we got another step backwards. It's been about 15 years. I'm glad that in some ways that Caroline hasn't had to see it. But supposing we have some aspiration, real aspiration, not Gove-style aspiration, real aspiration. Suppose that we decide that no school should be a sink school, that the state education we have in the four countries of the UK should be at least as good as the average in Europe. That's an aspiration. And how do we measure it? We measure it by fewer and fewer upper middle class parents choosing to send their child privately. That is how I would measure it. I wouldn't abolish private education. I would use it as the way to gauge your state education system is actually working. Suppose we decided that we were not going to have so many tens of thousands of lower working class children being expelled from our schools every year. It's an incredible, incredible number. In other countries, it is extremely rare for a child to be expelled. It happens when there's violence. And the agent of the state comes and collects the child from school and takes them to the next school. Because other countries in Europe have a very different attitude to their children. They see them as their children, like their own children, which is quite hard to do in a society as divided as our society, where other people's children are the kind of flotsam and jetsam of the lower orders, to be looked after, corralled, educated for a certain place in society. But they're not our children. That's how we've ended up. Comprehensive schools did improve our lives massively. They were a huge improvement on what we had before. That's why 60 organisations in October, including the Royal Society for Arts and Commons, put their names to a letter in the Times pleading that the ban on new grammar schools isn't lifted. I'm not going to go through the evidence that grammars were a very bad thing compared to comprehensive. They were a good thing compared to what came before 1944. But the evidence simply doesn't exist that they're better than a comprehensive system. It is possible to select a subset, a small group of grammar schools, and to suggest the minority of children from poor backgrounds have actually managed to attend that small set do go on to get slightly better GCSE results. That's about the best I can see you can do. But it doesn't provide evidence that the grammar school model is better in general. Nor does this obsession with grammar schools question the English orthodoxy that it's always better to get higher grades in exams. If we needed lots of adults who were especially skilled at exam technique in future, then this would be a good education system. If there was a world market, well, maybe there will. You know, the world's going to become terrible and our young people will be able to make up exam answers for other young affluent people in the world, and we could do that. But it's not what you need. What you need are people with confidence, imagination, who've enjoyed science and mathematics, who can program computers, who can turn things around in their minds. These are the young European researchers that we've been employing at our universities for the last 20 years. because they walk out of university from the mainland able to do things in the way that our children are not walking out of universities as able as children on the mainland of Europe. Why do you think so many university staff in the UK are EU citizens but not UK citizens? It is partly because they are better able to do things. The argument for grammar schools is very similar to the argument for Brexit, and it's a similar demographic and a similar popularity. The latest figures I could find said that more people are in favour of creating new grammar schools, 38%, than would be in favour of ending selection in those that already exist, which is only 23%. Among those who attended grammar schools, 61% would like more to be built. We do tend to like the education system we had. Even that which involved boarding and beating, people seem, eventually they come out and say it was a really bad idea, but we do tend to like the education system we've had. The majority of people in this country, and this is where I want to have, and if you'd like, maybe an argument with you and with Guardian readers, the majority of people in this country do not want to defend the 1970s. They don't want to defend the 1970s model of comprehensive schooling. They want something better. They're being offered something worse, but they want something better. They also don't want to defend 1970s council housing. It was very good for the 1970s, but people want something better. And we have a problem on the left, in that we have numerous campaigns to defend the 1970s. And it isn't what the left used to do. What the left used to do is suggest things that were completely new, fight for them and get them in, not look back at a different age. I don't think that most people who are in favour of grammar schools are stupid enough to think that all their children or grandchildren will actually pass the 11 plus. I don't think that's what's going on. But unfortunately, again, when we compare ourselves to other parts of Europe, we do contain higher than average numbers of people who think that they or their children have higher than average ability. It's the same when you ask people in Britain if they're good at driving or if they're good looking. In more unequal countries, more people say they're better than average. In a more economically equal country, it's remarkable how people begin to head towards 50-50. And we call them dour. And they're just realistic and sensible and numerate and clever. They're not arrogant. Comprehensive education has improved massively since its inception mainly in the 1970s. It was mostly in the 1970s that most counties went comprehensive. It makes little sense today to send your child to a private school. And this is not widely realised. Often the calculations that parents make about sending, and this is upper middle class parents, a group who can actually afford it, make about sending their child to a private school, are based on past probabilities. The probabilities that apply to them, not to their children. Particularly about university entry chances and graduate wages. If I had gone to the nearest elite private school to my house, I grew up in Oxford, it was only 3 miles away, I'd have been at least 10 times more likely to go to university. So it would, if my parents had not worried about segregating me from the rest of society at an early age and wanted to put me into a stiff little uniform, it would have made sense for them to spend the money for that massive increase in the chances if you think going to university is that important. Today, half the children from the comprehensive I went to go to university. The proportion from that elite private school is just the same, it's almost all of them, but it's smaller. And so the chances are no longer tenfold difference. They are orders of percentages different. And what's more, if you send your child to the elite private school, they will almost certainly disappoint you. Because what they're supposed to do is to get into one of two universities. And even from one of the most expensive boarding schools in the country, only one in three children managed to do that. So two out of three actually fail at the age of 18 what all that money was paying for, and they know it. They absolutely know it. And they end up in a Russell Group university alongside the children from the nearest comprehensive. So what were they doing wasting the money? Things really have got better. There has been enormous progress. The saddest thing is they only end up in certain Russell Group universities because they are absolutely afraid. That is why when they don't get into Oxford or Cambridge, they go, I won't name the ones, you probably know which they are. It's not because they're being snobby, because they're petrified of the society that they haven't been part of. And this is very, very sad, I think. I don't think we look enough at the top end of education. I think if we did, and we realised what a mess it was, then the reform of education would happen more quickly. We have secondary models already in this country, in the private sector mainly, not in the counties that have grammars. In every town in the south of England, there are private schools that you go to when you fail your entrance exam to the elite private schools. These are secondary models. And people are paying money for it. But people want something better than what we've currently got. They don't want their child to have to attend a local comprehensive that is severely underfunded following years of education cuts, hidden under the pretense of the supposed ring-fenced education budget, which is a lie. It hasn't been ring-fenced. The 16, 17-year-old budget's been decimated about three times. We're about to see the most draconian cuts to primary school funding in poor areas in the next few months coming through. People do not want their child assigned to the comprehensive school in which almost all the teachers are very young because staff turnover is so very high. You can see the grading of schools in an area, not just through the league tables and results, but through the average age of the teachers when you walk in to the school. And they don't want their child assigned to that school which the entire middle class know to avoid, which now happens in a way that didn't happen in my childhood. One thing was much better in my childhood. Because we had just got rid of the secondary modern grammar divide, nobody quite knew what a good or a bad comprehensive was. Often, and this is the case both in Sheffield, where I used to live for 10 years, and Oxford, where I now live, often the secondary modern was in the poshest part of town. Charwell School in Oxford was the secondary modern in the north of the town. In the south of the town, in Cowley, in the poorest area, was the old county grammar. You make them all comprehensives, and nobody quite knows, because the posh school was the one in the poor area, and the poor school was the one in the posh area. Same in Sheffield, where the grammars were in the middle of the town, which of course is now the area of high immigration, and up on the outskirts with the secondary modern, which is now the most famous comprehensive. The reason we have to change our system from what we had in the 70s is that because we published school league tables in the 90s, parents began to move between the schools, and as soon as the league tables are published, the parents move, the gaps will get bigger, and you then begin to get a house price gulf. And so you don't have a fair system of entry. It depends on whether you can afford to pay for the catchment. Parents also, though, don't want their normal children, most of us are normal, to be forced to attend an average school, which is an exam factory. And that's why I think there's some support for secondary models again. An exam factory in which every C and B that can be squeezed out of them will be squeezed out of them, in which not going to university is categorised as failure. Half our boys don't go to university, and that's categorised as failure. And in which the child is a problem for the school. I think there is some wish to go back to the past because of what happens to average children in our current system. Just like Brexit, the offer on the table at the moment for May is currently change to business as usual. What Labour are saying is business as usual, maybe something more different. What May is offering is change, something different to what you've had before. Business as usual is now a complex competing set of schools, most often academies, controlled by dubious boards of trustees. That's how I'm going to describe them. I know it really upsets people, I know there'll be trustees here, but I think it's the only fair way to describe what's happened to the governorship of our schools. Often the trustees are dominated by business people. Who chooses them? Who decided this? Who decided we'd have to have an accountant as a trustee? And these academies, which are businesses, already have selection at age 16. And Labour did this. Andrew Adonis put that into the legislation. And they can refuse to take pupils that they have themselves taught, whose GCSEs are not high enough. And they evict them. They evict them, in effect, on the day after GCSE results. And they've got a few days to find themselves somewhere else to go at the age of 17. Different children need different challenges at different ages. Other countries understand this. Right? All our children are not all the same. It's not that there are bright, clever, golden children that will become little Michael Goves. And other children, I promise not to mention Michael again. And other children who will always be dullards. Right? We vary in what we are best at. We get better at what we enjoy. You get much better when you practice it. You vary at what age you enjoy things and what age you don't. And so schooling which is segregated is bad for everybody. The grammar schools were particularly bad for those kids who just passed the 11 plus, just got into them, and then felt they were really stupid for the rest of their schooling career. Elite public schools, at least they've stopped this recently, used to rank all the boys each year and announce rank in assembly. And to get into that elite school, you had to pass an entrance exam, the privilege of which later was to then be told that you were the lowest in the school. You know, we vary. We have good years and bad years. You need a school system that can help with that. Labour, in a way, by defending comprehensives, are offering the 1970s, in a way like offering Europe. The Tories are offering the 1950s, grammars and out of Europe. What teachers want is stability and a livable workload. Parents want some certainty for their children. Children want to go to school with their friends and be able to stay at that school, including at 16, 17 and 18, if they like their school. Children are shaped by how we treat them. They often grow up to think that the way they were educated was good. We all do this, just as we all tend to take on the religion that our parents gave us. But children only have one childhood. That's why we have to worry about this. When it comes to public reform, the UK, particularly Labour, has tended to make serious changes to public service provision when it was forced to do so. The NHS was introduced in 1948, partly, if not mainly, because the middle classes could no longer afford private doctors' fees in the 1930s. It wasn't just a wonderful revolution in a brilliant way of providing health. It was the middle classes not being able to afford a private doctor after the war that helped bring the NHS in. Grammar schools were abolished, partly because we became so economically equal in the 1960s and the 70s, that the upper middle classes, who before that time had had enough money so that if little, actually it won't be little Johnny, it'll be little Jill, because of course there are a few grammar schools for girls, so we made it harder. If little Jill didn't pass for 11 plus, you could pay for her to go privately. Growing economic equality in the UK meant that the upper middle classes couldn't afford that option and were horrified by the idea of their children going to a secondary modern. And they were vital in Caroline's campaign to get comprehensives in. things can get a lot better when the middle classes think it's getting worse for them. My favourite example is John Snow, not far from here in Soho, who drew that map of deaths of cholera in the 1840s and managed to convince the middle classes that it was spread by water and that they were susceptible to it, whereas in fact, simply by living in an area with a slightly better water supply, they could be fine. But John Snow didn't tell them that, and so we got sewers and public health. Children in Europe are best served in countries such as Finland. I'm sure most of you have heard this all before. In Finland, there is no equivalent to Ofsted. You do not need Ofsted. There are no league tables. A small random sample of pupils' work is occasionally tested to monitor school performance, not pupil performance. Children are not widgets being processed by a statistical process exercise. We are a very long way of achieving anything like this. But we could begin to move towards it. And we could particularly begin to move towards it as we begin to run out of money. There is a plus side to running out of money. It is incredibly expensive to have all these separate academy schools. Free schools are even more expensive. The private sector is unbelievably expensive. We spend an enormous amount on our education, very badly. The equivalent is the United States, not for education but for health. The United States spends more on healthcare than any other country in the rich world and has by far the worst outcomes in terms of health. We are spending an enormous amount on education, mainly on a small number of children, but the total is enormous and the results are not good. What do I suggest you do? We now have senior management teams in our schools. We didn't have senior management teams when I was a child. They are large and they are expensive. Do two neighbouring schools really need two separate senior management teams? Or could one senior management team do a better job than those two? One senior management team could move teachers between the school sites, and you could begin to move pupils between the school sites, which means that you can run A-levels that neither school could run on its own. But which also means that you don't end up with one school with all the young teachers in it. And by young, I mean 22, 23 and 24, and occasionally 25. And the other school with the teachers over 30 in it. One senior management team allows you to move your staff between the sites. You can keep the names of the sites. Whenever we've changed education in this country, we have kept the same buildings. You can draw wonderful maps of schooling systems over time, and I've done it for Scunthorpe, but you can do it in Oxford. And you can see the same building being used again and again for different models of schooling. In Oxford, sadly, the universities have slowly taken over the buildings in the middle, and the schools are being pushed out to the edge. What we need is more cooperation rather than competition. Competition between schools produces awful results. Competition between schools leads to teachers being fearful of GCSE and A-level results day. It leads to them pushing the children to get these particular letters or numbers, which doesn't mean they actually learn. It leads to senior teachers spreading rumours about the use of drugs in different schools because the reputation really matters. I'm not going to name any names, but I have seen it happen. Incidentally, if you're interested in drug use in schools, my impression, and I'd love it if any of you can tell me of any solid evidence on this, is that the use of drugs in schools appears to me to be highly correlated to parents' income. The lowest drug use I have seen in schools is in the poorest schools, because you cannot nick £10 from your dad's wallet in a poor school and he not notice it. The highest drug use I have seen in state schools is in the school with the poshest catchment, because then you can get the money that you need to buy some drugs. But by far the highest use of drugs in our schools is in those schools where the children are from the very richest families of all. I'll say no more because it's based on anecdote, but we shouldn't have this current system. Years ago, Michael Young, in 1958, described the nightmare vision of a meritocracy in the year 2033, in which he quipped that a few gifted children from the labouring classes could be extracted from the masses, so that no longer is it necessary to debase the standards by attempting to extend a higher civilization to the children of the lower classes. We're there earlier than 2033. That is the thinking behind the return of grammar schools. Find a few golden children, teach them well, dumb down the rest. If we really wanted a higher civilization to result from how we educate children, we'd remember these warnings from Michael Young, and we'd also remember warnings from when we were becoming more equal. It's been a very, very long time since this country has been becoming more equal. We are now the economically most unequal country in Europe. We are as unequal as we've been at any time since the early 1930s. You have to go back to the 1930s to find a time when we were making progress when it came to educational equality, accompanied by economic inequality also narrowing. And it was at that time that Richard Tawney wrote this. Richard said, "The fundamental obstacle in the way of education in England is simple. It's that education is a spiritual activity, much of which is not commercially profitable. And that the prevailing temper of the Englishman is to regard as most important that which is commercially profitable, and of only inferior importance that which is not. We should provide not merely as hitherto for a small minority, but for all the nation's sons and daughters an education generous, inspiring, and humane." And Tawney's words were followed at that time. They weren't just followed by people devising better state education. In the private sector, almost all schools are charitable because the people who use them understand that if they were profit-making, they would be absolutely terrible places to send their children. And so I'm actually in favour of maintaining the charitable status of private schools, because I think you unleash something much, much worse if you get rid of it. Our current education system is not generous. We are spending very, very little per child now, and we segregate much more than other countries. It is not inspiring, as Tawney wanted. Teachers are forced to teach this set curriculum and to concentrate on exams, which are constantly being tinkered with by politicians. We've got cohorts of children now going through with numbers and letters, and it's all changing. And the politicians who are doing the tinkering are driven by their own leadership ambitions and trying to demonstrate their own apparent prowess. And our education system is not humane. Children are units, products in the model of competition aimed at producing a docile, unimaginative workforce. However, our education system is more humane than it was when I was a child, when it was legal to beat children in schools. We do need to move towards this cooperative, collaborative, comprehensive system. We need to move towards it slowly, area by area, as we did when we introduced comprehensives. We do need pairs of schools, and then larger numbers of schools in a London borough or in a city like Oxford, to be being governed and managed by one senior management team, to save money, but also to stop having selection by house price, which is what has now happened to comprehensives. You don't just move the teachers around between your sites when you have a single management team. You can also begin to move the children between sites. You do have to make it safe to actually move and cycle. Other European countries do manage to do that. It's not beyond the wit to do it. Once you can do that, and I don't care whether you call it the Oxford University Grammar Academy School, right? It has six sites, I know where they are. You can give it the most pompous titled name you want, it's better to just call it Cooperative School. Why would people pay £200,000 or £300,000 for a house in one part of town rather than another if that wasn't guaranteeing you access to one or the other? I'm not suggesting a lottery, as Brighton went for, partly because of the traffic chaos. I'm suggesting you begin to move towards cooperation on a greater and greater level. You take this forward slowly, and it has to be done by areas that locally choose to do it. And then you can begin to think of things like putting all your chemistry labs in one building in your small city. And then the science provision in the state sector is better than any of the science provision in the private sector in that city. Put the language labs into one. Begin to do things in a more efficient way as you've run out of money. Move the teachers around so they're not always stuck in one particular school. Publish league tables for the entire town, not for the individual sites. We need to begin to do things like this because this new division has opened up between our schools. I've talked for long enough. Let me end with a quote from Caroline. Caroline wrote, I'll check when, some time ago in the Telegraph.
Some time ago.
Once a sound and universal comprehensive system has been established for everyone from 11 to 18, a fractional percentage of selective schools or a hangover sector for the rich is not necessarily alarming. As I said early on, I would use as a measure of success the upper middle class not spending their money and sending their children privately. I think we need to enable local areas to merge the senior management teams of schools so that they can provide something better than they can currently provide. The form of management, I've written about it in The Guardian that I would suggest, is that your governing body includes a majority of teachers, some parents and some students. It's rather like an LEA in the past, but not just councillors. This governing body may sound utopian. It's a former governing body that has operated for 800 years in the city I was born in. It's what an Oxford College governing body is. The people actually doing the teaching, and some of the students and some others, run the institution and have the power to sack the head, which every governing body in an Oxford College does have. If some of this sounds fanciful to you, try to imagine how fanciful it sounded in the 1930s and 40s when people talked about the possibility of having an education which everybody would go to the same school. It would have sounded absolutely ridiculous. Or go back another 30 years and imagine somebody talking about women being allowed to go to university in the same numbers as men. It would have sounded ridiculous. One problem you have with trying to come up with ideas which are progressive is that if they really are progressive, they must sound as if they're not achievable. Otherwise, it's piecemeal. I honestly believe that we will not have our current system in 30 years' time. If I have grandchildren, I do not believe that my grandchildren will have the same choice, and my children, as their parents, will have the same choice between these sites of schools. I think we'll have developed something which is much better, and that's an easy prediction to make. Because you can't be at the bottom of the European league table and do anything else but actually get better. I think we'll have developed something much better. And I also believe, because it's a legacy of empire, that most of our private schooling would have gone because we will not be able to afford it anymore or see the use of it. And if you want to see an example of this, then go to one of Oxford's twin cities, which is Bonn. In Bonn, the vast majority of the schooling is provided by the state. It takes teachers in Bonn quite a long time to rank the schools. The Beethoven Academy is a bit posher than the other ones. And of course, they do have segregation in Germany, but it's not as vicious as ours. And in Bonn, there is only one well-known private school. And that well-known private school in Bonn is for the very slow children of the very upper classes. And their most famous pupil was Prince Philip. That is happening now on the mainland. The idea that we are somehow going to carry on as we have carried on is impossible. We have an education system as we have because of a legacy of empire. It was empire that paid for this, and that's why we're so unusual. That empire really has gone. The Brexit vote is not going to make Britain great again or the richest country in the world again. We're going to run out of money. But when we run out of money, which we did in the early 1940s and we were again in the 70s, you can do better things. Because that's when we got our health service, universal health service. That's when we got our universal education. I really wouldn't despair about what's going to happen, but if you can't come up with plans, then they will not happen. Thank you very much.
Well, can I just say thank you very much.